Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 84 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling WSU's Spring Wheat Breeder, Plant Scientist, Geneticist, Plant Pathologist, and Professor Mike Pumphrey. About the second half of my conversation with the College of Agriculture and Human and Natural Resource Sciences Assistant Professor at Washington State University. In episode 83 of my podcast featuring Pumphrey, he took a big picture look at a lot of issues. Here, he gets into the more nitty-gritty work of his breeding program and research projects. We go into some detail about the falling numbers phenomenon, which comes in two flavors. Late maturity alpha amylase, or LMA, is the result of a spring temperature shock, whereas pre-harvest sprout, also known as PHS, is caused the traditional way, by rain falling on mature crops. As I record this podcast in mid-July, early samples of the 2018 harvest haven't shown falling number problems, but the jury is still very much out. We also talk about the Coaxium herbicide-tolerant system that was developed by the Colorado Wheat Research Foundation and Colorado State University with participation by the seed company Limagrain and the chemical company Alba. A mutagenesis-developed wheat that is resistant to the herbicide aggressor is key, but Pumphrey said Eastern Washington adapted lines aren't right around the corner. You can learn more about the herbicide-resistant trait in episode 70 entitled Chad Shelton, Man of Many Herbicides. We also talk about facultative wheat, speeding up the variety release timetable, and low soil pH, among other things. I opened up by asking Pumphrey whether the fact that upwards of 90% of Eastern Washington's wheat crop is exported causes him to breed wheat any differently than he would for domestic consumers.
Not really. You know, when I set out in the breeding process, I think about the grower first. That's the primary stakeholder that supports the work I do. I think about the user, the processor, and then ultimately the consumer. And so whether that's a sponge cake or a noodle product going into Asia, or whether it's a loaf of bread or tortilla consumed here in the U.S., I just kind of consider the whole supply chain in those selection and release decisions.
Have you ever run across a problem more vexing than the falling numbers phenomenon?
Yeah, I have.
And what would that be?
You know, we have many old vexing problems. We just don't talk about as much. But, you know, I think part of the issue with falling numbers, whether it's pre-harvest sprouting or late maturity alpha amylase, is they're quite intermittent and somewhat of a new problem because we've started testing more regularly for those traits. But if we look back, things like most of our soil-borne fungal diseases, things like Fusarium crown rot, foot rot, snow mold, Fusarium head blight, which is, you know, an increasing concern in irrigated areas in the region, but also across the U.S. and world. Those are, I would say, equally, if not more complicated and more vexing in that they're even more expensive to screen for, more time-consuming, require more expertise. So I'm not totally daunted by falling numbers. I think it is a huge problem. It's something that we're aggressively going after, but at the same time, I think because it's kind of a new problem, I think we'll be able to make progress pretty quick.
Do you believe that the genetic defect that causes late maturity alpha amylase has always been in our germplasm, or did it get brought in from outside the program?
Defining what our germplasm is kind of answers that question. And the reality is we have germplasm that came here with settlers and amateur breeders 100 years ago. We have germplasm that was exchanged in the meantime. And then we had the more sort of massive influx of semi-dwarf varieties that were spread around the world over the past, say, 40 years. So I guess the answer is I think it's been in our germplasm. It's been in our germplasm a long time ago. It's been in and out of our germplasm even with recent introductions. I don't think it's a new thing. I think the testing that's been done in recent years due to a few years that had bad sprouting caused widespread testing that got really widely adopted by all elements of the grain handling system, and it's just tested, so now we know every year.
What are you doing to ensure the defect doesn't contaminate future releases?
We're working, from a basic research standpoint and actually trying to improve how we do the testing and selection. We're trying to improve the tests themselves. From my applied breeding perspective, we plant everything in locations across the state. If one of those locations has a problem, we know that because we test lines in that location that we know would have the problem if it existed. And then we test everything grown at that location. So basically, I'm throwing away lines every year that give a low falling number in the absence of rain. What we haven't done personally is really go after the pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. And that's another really complicated, slightly different issue, but does affect falling numbers in the end.
Yeah, but it's sort of like we all know about pre-harvest sprout. This LMA thing was a real new one for us.
That's true.
Well, I understand that Australia, for instance, will not let any variety be released that has this LMA defect. How does one go about ascertaining whether a variety has an LMA defect?
So we, in Australia, the system they would use, they have a scientist that runs a program that basically grows plants in the greenhouse, changes the temperature at the right time to try to induce this problem, and then measures the enzyme activity afterwards. We do those exact same type of experiments. We've been working on optimizing that screening system. We also, because of the sort of integrated nature and also expansive nature of our field testing programs, we simply test lines, we plant and test lines that we know have problems across variable locations. And if any given location had an LMA event, had the right weather conditions at the right time, then that allows us to just directly do a falling numbers assay on the harvested grain from all those plots and do the screening. So we have both controlled environment and field screening.
But there isn't a gene that you can look at in the variety and say, okay, that one's out. It's got the LMA gene.
There's been genetic mapping work done on this trait over the past, say, 15 to 20 years, and there have been a few genes, or I say genes, we don't know the gene, but there have been a few regions of the chromosome that have consistently been associated with low falling numbers due to late maturity off amylase. At this point in time in the Pacific Northwest, we don't know exactly what those genes or alleles, if you will, are. We don't have a single marker that we can use to say, yes, this is good, no, this is bad. And that's the kind of research we're conducting and with support of the Grain Commission, federal funding, state funding to get to that point.
You breed both red and white wheat. Are red spring wheats just as susceptible to LMA as other classes?
I think it's maybe hard to generalize that. Now, just kind of very specifically, the pre-harvest sprouting red wheats are more tolerant. The red seed color genes actually help prevent sprouting. For LMA, there's no such direct link I've ever heard of. I think you can have a hard red wheat just be as susceptible to late maturity off amylase. However, red wheats have historically been grown in areas that get summer rain, that the breeders and quality labs have been running falling numbers more consistently, so they have selected harder for high falling numbers over decades. So I think on average, our hard red wheat germplasm is less likely to have an LMA problem because it's been screened sort of blindly, whether it was falling numbers due to pre-harvest sprouting or falling numbers due to LMA. They've eliminated those lines over time with low falling numbers.
Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time working with the ARS scientist Camille Stieber on falling numbers. Are you going to continue that research with her, or will you be pulling back to focus on your priorities with a new quality person coming into the ARS focusing on falling numbers?
For now, our plan is to just keep doing what needs to be done and doing the right kind of research to benefit the breeding process, to benefit the growers. And so, people come and go, programs change. For now, my priority is just on doing the immediate things that we feel are of most value to the wheat industry. I look forward to a new person coming on that can really ramp up those efforts. We've kind of managed it on a shoestring budget, but definitely delegated authority and not really centralized. And so it'll be nice to have a point person to help lead those efforts. But I think from at least a breeding perspective, we're going to continue screening and selecting tolerant lines. And this position may or may not have the resources to do that at the scale that a breeding program needs.
Okay, well, here's another one. We have, it's not a class, but it's a label, facultative wheat. It is spring wheat that is basically planted in the winter. It seems mostly an irrigated practice now. Do you think that facultative wheat has a chance of going big time in the dryland areas?
You know, that's really too complex of a question for me to answer myself. There are definitely years and times and systems where that later planting or, you know, even midwinter planting would be desirable. Those aren't mainstream right now, but there are definitely situations where that later planting is either kind of essential to get a crop or desirable. There are different challenges, though. When you change a system like that, you have to change everything. Oftentimes the equipment, the agronomy, the weed science, the herbicides, the disease control, and it's not simple. And so if you tell me to focus on facultative wheat exclusively using spring wheat germplasm mainly, I could be missing the boat for everything else, like the winter wheat root diseases that spring wheat just doesn't have in the region. So it's complicated. That would be, for it to be the keystone crop or really take over broad acres, would be a long-term integrated effort and a systems approach to get that to be successful.
I did a podcast with Jen Vanderwall, the breeder at Syngenta, and she told me that she had a variety that she released in 5 years from first cross. And she said that's not an outlier. If a five-year schedule for releasing varieties is adopted, how will that change the complexion of breeding?
It can be a double-edged sword. As a breeder, in the textbooks that we teach from and the lectures I give in a classroom, I grill into graduate students that cycle time, that is the time between when you make a cross, select that line, and then cross again, that is critical in the rate of genetic improvement in plant breeding and basically the rate of progress. So we want it to be fast, as long as it's accurate. And so I guess you can also translate that to a grower, is that they could have better varieties quicker and continue to get better quicker. However, there probably is going to be a little bit of risk along the way when something has not been tested in that off year or that really cold winter killed year or whatever it may be. So I think it's an exciting thing as a breeder to be talking about technologies like genomic selection and doubled haploids that speed up the breeding process and accelerate the rate of genetic gain. But it could also mean that something hasn't been tested just quite enough for that off trade or disease or year, and farmers could have greater risk.
Now, you could theoretically develop a wheat in 5 years, but then it has to go through 3 years of testing. Isn't that right?
In my program, every wheat we develop is developed in 5 years already. And what I mean by that is it's a fixed line. Actually, within only 3 years in spring wheat, we go from the cross to having stable fixed lines that are tested. The next 3 years, we use testing across diverse locations before we put it into the 2 years of variety testing. So basically, as it sits now, I'm on about an eight-year cycle. 3 years to develop the fixed lines, 3 years to test them in my own program, 2 years to test them in a statewide independent testing program. And those 5 years of multi-location testing tell you a lot about the stability, the performance, the characteristics. It gives you a greater chance of seeing that off year, that really heavy rust year, that Hessian fly epidemic, that winter kill, you know, that snow mold year, so that when you put it out there, you have the sort of total package of information that a grower in a specific region might need.
And these are things that you just can't know by looking at it in the lab.
I wish we could. If we could, we'd save a lot of money and we'd restructure our programs dramatically. We'd have a lot less trailers and fuel and road time, and we'd have a lot more greenhouse and laboratory selection efforts and different types of equipment. But the answer is the technology is just not there yet to do that.
You're working with the coaxium herbicide tolerance system that ALBA is bringing out in cooperation with Lima Green and Colorado State University. When do you think your first Pacific Northwest adapted coaxium variety will be released?
For a spring wheat variety, we're just now, as of this past year, doing the back crossing into a handful of elite genetic backgrounds. I'm actually sort of tentatively approaching this. I've talked with our weed scientists in the region and here at Washington State University. And for spring wheat, we don't see a super strong need or demand for this system. For winter wheat, it's definitely the focus, and the winter wheat programs here are working with it as well. So basically, I'm initially crossing it into germplasm that I think may be grown in systems where it might be of benefit. A good example of that, which you brought up earlier, was facultative hard red spring wheat. That is a system where we can have problems with winter annual grassy weeds in a quote-unquote spring wheat crop. Because germination times and planting times of things like downy brome actually coincide with those facultative types. So that is our emphasis for now. As far as timing goes, I would say cautiously optimistic outlook would be 6 to 7 years from now. And that's basically these first 2 years to get it into those backgrounds through back crossing, 3 good years of testing, 2 good years of variety testing, and then you're talking about a product.
And that's going to be even longer for winter wheat, right?
It could be at a similar timeline. By using doubled haploids, they could be looking at a somewhat similar timeline depending on the number of crosses. And winter wheat kind of has an advantage in that the donors are coming from winter wheat. So I'm actually having to use winter wheat lines with these traits in them to cross into spring wheat and kind of make it, you know, no longer flower too long and survive the winter and all those things. So for some of the winter wheat germplasm, particularly hard red winter wheat, I could see that it would be as simple as a single cross with a double haploid step, and you're pretty much right in that 6-year time.
Acid soils, how big is the problem, and do you expect it to become a bigger problem? What's the answer? Is it aluminum tolerance or liming?
You know, I don't know the exact number of acres that aluminum tolerance is necessary in wheat in this area, but you know, survey data by soil scientists in the region have shown tens of thousands, potentially up to around 100,000 acres already at risk or reaching those critical pH thresholds. That number is growing. Every year we have, a ammoniacal nitrogen application that's acidifying the soil. Increasingly in no-till systems where we're really stratifying the pH layer, the number of acres affected by low pH is growing every single year. The solution is not one or the other. It's complex, like most things we do. Aluminum tolerance, there are some simply inherited traits in wheat that we can select for. That's critically important. At the same time, the management, the entire system, how it's cultivated, offsetting that acidification with lime applications, those are all important as well. So it's going to take a really comprehensive systems approach to solve that issue long term.
What about using different types of fertilizer? Is that something that you've looked at all?
I personally haven't. We have faculty in crop and soils in the USDA here in Pullman that do that type of research, but basically the synthetic high application rate nitrogen fertilizers are what have been responsible for the rate of acidification, and things like manures, biochars, others can slow that down or actually mitigate it by adding some buffering capacity to the soil. But the problem is the quantity and supply of those, and the bottom line, the price. There are diverse solutions. It's not simple, and especially for our sort of conventional production acres, it may or may not be cost effective at this time.
Given recent wheat prices, I think most everyone would agree it isn't cost effective to lime at this time. But the problem isn't going to magically go away. I got the fear of God put into me with regard to low soil pH in an early podcast I did. Episode 8 was titled simply Low Soil pH and included interviews with experts in 3 separate fields addressing the problem. If you haven't already listened to it, go to the Washington Grain Commission webpage at wagrains.org. That's wagrains.org. And then to podcast summaries. You can navigate back to earlier episodes using the feature at the right-hand bottom of the page. You can also discover how far I've come as a podcaster. I hope you've enjoyed these last 2 episodes featuring WSU's Spring Wheat Breeder, episode 83 entitled WSU's Spring Wheat Breeding Philosopher Mike Pumphrey, and episode 84, WSU's Spring Wheat Breeder, Plant Scientist, Geneticist, Plant Pathologist, and Professor Mike Pumphrey. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
Grass is fine if you've got a cut or 4 feet and stand in the mud, but we've got two and teeth to chew. Don't give us none of that vegetarian stew. We're carnivores and we ain't ashamed. The reason's simple, it's in the refrain. We feed you.